Good morning. Today is July 7th, 2020, and this is the Morning Bible Study. Well, back in February, we actually covered the end of this particular story here, the death of Absalom. And for the last several episodes, the last several Bible studies, we've been looking as David is slowly supplanted by his son Absalom, as Absalom begins to take center stage. And what we see here is Absalom now making a naked bid for power, and he does it kind of a little bit sneakily, a little bit surreptitiously, but eventually he is able to steal the hearts of the people of Judah, steal the hearts of the people of Jerusalem, and he declares himself to be king. So this morning we are going to look at the first half of chapter 15, or at least the first pericope in chapter 15, by reading chapter 15 of 2 Samuel, 2 Samuel 15, verses 1 through 12. And go ahead and pause your audio, read that text, and then we're going to dive right in. Okay, so, like I said, we here pick up Absalom as Absalom is beginning to kind of set up his scheme, begin his plot, begin his plan to overthrow his father David. And what we see is the way that he does it. The Bible is actually shockingly particular here about his methodologies. And that's really interesting because, you know, in a lot of places, the Bible seems to just kind of skim over details like that. But when there is attention placed to details in the how, then the how we know has some kind of significance. Remember, and this is my general rule with the scriptures, if you could tell the narrative, if you could tell the story, if you could make the theological point without a certain detail, then the detail is there for a reason. Okay, so if you could eliminate it and still get the main thrust of the statement, then you know that it's not simply an accidental addition or not simply incidental to the story, but it has some kind of theological or exegetical or homiletical significance. Okay, so the fact that we're told, we could simply be told that this whole section, I mean, a lot of it about Absalom could simply be ignored, right? We could simply be told the Bible, if it wanted to include the rebellion, could simply say, and in accordance with the word spoken by the prophet Nathanael, one of David's sons rose up against him, but he was struck down by Joab, the son of Zeruiah. And I mean, that would be a very biblical way of saying it. I think that actually sounds quite like how the Bible would phrase it, right? So it could have been said like that. It could have been said like that, but it wasn't. And in fact, we spend a significant portion of time talking about Absalom's rebellion and talking about how Absalom stands up and refuses to simply be a prince anymore. He insists on being a king and how he does his rebellion. And so we ought to pay close attention here. There is a lot of significance here, and we would do well to appreciate it and to try to understand it. When we simply gloss over these details, we miss out on a lot of good stuff. So I hope we're going to pay very close attention here and try, and hopefully you at home who are listening, and I would hope that you would be, as we're going through this, you would be trying to discern for yourself, what is the theological significance of this? Why are these details here when they could simply be omitted or glossed over? So, beginning in chapter 15, verse 1, sometime later, that is, after Absalom had returned and been received by his father, Absalom managed to acquire a chariot and horses. Now, of course, the Net Bible is interesting in how it phrases that. He says he managed to acquire as though someone were resisting him, where they put a note that says that maybe a more literal Hebrew is he acquired for himself a chariot and horses, as well as 50 men to serve as his royal guard, or again, the NIV here says 50 men to run ahead of him. Now, Absalom used to get up early and stand beside the road that led to the city gate. Whenever anyone came by, heard a complaint, who had a complaint to bring to the king for arbitration, Absalom would call out to him, you know, what city are you from? The person would answer, I, your servant, am from one of the tribes of Israel. Okay, so it's interesting here that the people recognize Absalom as the prince. They recognize him as the crown prince, the person who will someday be the king. And so they use this honorific title with him, or this humilarific. I'm not sure what we call this, but when you use that title for yourself, your servant, you know, that there's probably a name for it, and I just don't know what it is. But when you use that with royalty. So they're treating Absalom as royalty. And Absalom, now it's interesting, the Bible is not badly written, right? Like, the person would say, I'm from one of the tribes of Israel, and Absalom would say, look, your claims are legitimate and appropriate. Notice, we don't even know what these claims are. That's what he would say to everybody. Anybody who came up to him who said that they wanted, you know, to get some kind of arbitration, he would say, hey, look, you've got justice on your side, but there's no representative of the king who will listen to you. Okay, well, is that true? I mean, that's what Absalom is saying, but is that true? Well, no, it's not true. How do I know it's not true? Well, just scroll up. How did Absalom get brought back? Because the king was hearing complaints. The king was hearing arbitration cases. The king was actually doing what kings in the ancient world and through most of history were supposed to do, which is to act as a judge. And so the king does this, and Absalom is in Israel because of this. This is significant. Moreover, do not miss the irony here. Do not miss the irony of Absalom playing the judge as the means of fomenting his rebellion. Think about that. I want to come back to that later. Think about the irony of Absalom playing the judge to foment his rebellion. And he would say, if only they would make me a judge in the land, then everyone who had a complaint could come to me and I would be sure he receives a just settlement. And when anyone approached to bow down before him, Absalom would extend his hand and embrace him and kiss him. And Absalom was this way toward everyone in Israel who came to the king for justice. In this way, Absalom won the loyalty of the citizens of Israel. That's what the Net Bible says. It stole the heart of the people of Israel, of the men of Israel. Absalom is not a stupid man. David was not a stupid man. David was a brilliant man. And Absalom apparently was like David in many, many, many ways. But he was not like David in every way. And we see that Absalom was the consummate politician. He was handsome. He was charming. He didn't let people bow down to him. He constantly flattered them. And when people tried to bow down to him, he lifted them up and kissed him. And he promised to get justice. And he said, oh, if only I were appointed a judge, I would see that people get justice. Oh, there was a commercial we used to laugh about when I was back in my carpentering days, where a former person who ran for I forget, either governor or senator of Ohio, and this guy's brother came on and he said, I won't use the person's name, but I think my brother wakes up every my brother wakes up every morning wondering what he can do for the people of Ohio. Okay, first of all, if the first thought you have when you wake up in the morning is how can I help the people of Ohio, like, you're living a strange life. I mean, that's a charmed life. If you wake up in the morning and the first thought out of your head is, you know, why are my kids screaming, or my back hurts, or I've got to pee. If instead of those things, you're thinking, golly, I just need to help the people. Okay, no one believes that. That's the point. No one believes that. Like, the first thought in your mind when you wake up is, how can I help the people of Ohio? Like, I mean, that's the kind of level of flattery and ridiculousness and politicking we're seeing here, okay? Now, after 4 years, so Absalom does this 4 years on end. Absalom is not stupid. He's a fool, but he's not stupid. Absalom is brilliant, and Absalom is patient. After 4 years, Absalom said to the king, let me go and repay my vow that I made to the Lord while I was in Hebron. For I made this vow when I was living in Geshur in Aram. If the Lord really does allow me to return to Jerusalem, I will serve the Lord. And the king replied, go in peace. So Absalom got up and went to Hebron. Okay. Again, I could make this comment over and over and over in everywhere we study the Bible, anywhere you study the Bible. But with David and Jacob in particular, it stands out. Chickens come home to roost. There is a tremendous amount of literary irony or poetic irony in the Bible. And it happens here. David before has sworn peace with people, saying that he's going to go and do things when that wasn't his plan. He lied. He lied. He pretended to be peaceful when he was in Philistine territory, and it almost cost him. He swore a bad oath. He swore a false oath, or, well, maybe not a false oath. He swore a bad oath concerning Nabal. So he's been a false bringer of peace, and he's made oaths that he shouldn't have made. And here, what do we see? We see his own son promises peace based upon an oath when he doesn't mean to bring peace or to fulfill an oath or a vow. Chickens come home to roost. Yeah, Galatians is pretty clear. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that thereof also shall he reap. You will reap what you sow. You will reap what you sow. Now you say, well, Luke, that sounds like legalism. No, it doesn't sound like legalism. It sounds like we live in a universe created and sustained by a God of order and a God of justice. If you can't call the Bible, because Galatians is the Bible, you can't call the Bible where it says, whatsoever man sows, that thereof also shall he reap. You can't call that legalism. And also, quote, whosoever shall live by the sword shall die by the sword. We know that these principles are basic principles with almost, I won't say completely, but almost universal application. Look, the fact is, The fact of the matter is, if you engage in reckless behavior, sooner or later you will have to reap the consequences of your recklessness. If you live a life of single-minded selfishness, eventually you will die alone. You will make enemies. What you sow, you will reap. I have my garden, and I love my garden. But you know what the interesting thing about the garden is whatever seeds go in the ground, that's what grows. You know what I've never had grow out of my garden? This is a true story. You know what I've never had grow out of my garden? An orange tree. You know why? Well, one, because they don't grow around here. But two, I've never planted any orange seeds in that garden. You know what else I've never had grow? Never in all the years. You know what I've never had grow? Rutabagas. Never had any rutabagas in my garden. I don't plant rutabaga seeds. But you know what's funny is where I've planted corn, I've gotten corn. Where I planted sweet peas, I've gotten sweet peas. Where I've planted eggplant and tomato, I've gotten eggplant and tomato. Where I planted rye as a cover crop, you know what came up? Rye came up. You know what didn't come up? Wheat. Wheat didn't come up. Rye did, not wheat. And isn't that strange that the things that I plant, I also grow a lot of weeds, but I don't plant those. But it's very interesting that where I planted marigolds, I got marigolds. I didn't get roses. I didn't get lilies. I didn't get hydrangeas or hyacinths. I didn't get snapdragons. I didn't get milkweed. But you know what's funny is where I planted milkweed, I got milkweed. What you sow, you will reap. This is a basic, fundamental biblical principle, and I am really, really tired of people in conversations and in dialogue saying that that's legalism. Friends, it's not legalism. We have a God of order. If you live a life of sin, you will reap death. Now, does that mean that you lose your salvation? No, I'm not saying that. I've never said that. Am I saying that God can never miraculously halt the course of justice or suspend the course of natural consequences? No, I'm not saying that. Of course he can. Of course he can. But that's not the normal way things happen. In fact, It's so not normal that when God does do that, we call it what? Extraordinary. It is outside of the ordinary. It is beyond the ordinary course of human events. When God suspends the natural consequences that a person is going to face, do you know what happens? We call it extraordinary. When a crappy parent has kids turn out good, everybody says it's a marvel. It's a wonder. You know why? Because crappy parents almost always have crappy kids. Almost always. If you've got parents who are selfish, lazy, ignorant jerks, you know what their kids turn out to be? Selfish, lazy, ignorant jerks. It's pretty standard. It's a pretty standard thing. Most people are fairly aware of this. That crappy parents have crappy kids who grow up to be crappy adults. It's a pretty well-known fact. Now, sometimes that habit, that pattern, that cycle is interrupted by God. Sure, absolutely. Absolutely it is. But that's not the common thing. That's extraordinary. That is rare. David is, in this entire episode, he is reaping what he had sown. David had sown adultery and murder and deception and disloyalty. And this is what he's reaping. So the king, in ignorance, sends his son off. Go in peace. So Absalom went up to Hebron. Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel who said, when you hear the sound of the horn, you will know, or you may assume, that Absalom rules in Hebron. Now, 200 men had gone with Absalom from Jerusalem. Since they were invited, they were naively unaware of what Absalom was planning. While he was offering sacrifices, Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's advisor, to come from his city Gilo. The conspiracy was gaining momentum, and the people were starting to side with Absalom. Okay, so that's where we're going to stop today. We're going to pause right there, and we're going to go over just this one last thing, something I want us to see. Okay, have you gotten your conclusion? Remember I said that I wanted you to try to draw your own conclusions, and I asked you the very specific question, do you see the irony in Absalom demanding justice, that becoming a judge is his means of undermining his father's throne? Have you seen the irony yet? Have you seen it? Well, here's why. Let me give you at least part of the answer. Why was Absalom so enraged? First of all, why was Absalom exiled? Because he murdered his brother. Why did he murder his brother? Why? Well, the easy answer is because his brother raped his sister. Okay, that's the easy answer. What's the more realistic answer? Because David did nothing. Remember how we mentioned that a few episodes ago? How David just impotently was angry? And David did nothing? David did nothing. Why? Maybe it was because he was involved in some pretty horrific sexual sin. Have you considered that? You know? Maybe when Amnon raped Tamar, David said, well, am I really any better than my son? I seized that which didn't belong to me. I took what I didn't have a right to. How can I judge my son? Absalom says, I have no problem judging him. Absalom sees his father's failure to enact justice as an offense against him, as an offense against the kingdom, and as the justification for him to steal power from his father. His father, in his eyes, David, was no longer fit to be king because David was not giving justice. At least that may be what he told himself. This is a sad, sorry, and sordid story. But it makes sense. Just because something is pathetic doesn't mean that it's illogical. There is irony in David, who acted unjustly. And then God says he will enact justice against him by destroying four of his own children. And this is how he does it. all of this revolves around the concept of justice. David, who acted unjustly and then who wouldn't provide justice, is going to be brought down, or at least is going to be attempted to be brought down by his son, who says he's seeking justice by becoming a judge. There's irony there. If you don't see that, if you don't see that irony, you're missing something, friends. You're missing it. It's subtle. Yeah, it's not coming out and slapping you in the face, but it almost is. It's pretty close to that. And now, we have a final point I want us to make, which is this. What Absalom is doing, trying to steal the hearts of the people, this is exactly what Satan does. Now let's make this Christological here. If David is the Christ figure, and he's a very imperfect Christ figure here, but if David is the Christ figure, David is the legitimate ruler, the God-ordained ruler, and somebody wants to supplant him, and what does he say? How do you supplant a ruler? How do you supplant a popular ruler? Will you tell all the disgruntled and frustrated that the king does not care about them? How do you get people who have a good king to turn against their king? You get the people who are angry and bitter and frustrated, and you come down to their level, and you try to pretend that you're brothers, and you promise them that you are going to take care of their legitimate concerns and needs, and that unfortunately the king just doesn't care. Is that not exactly what we're hearing from people as critiques and criticisms of God? You know, I mean, that's the classic argument. It's not a very good argument, but it has a certain appeal. But that's the most common argument against God. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why is the world so full of evil? What is God? Is he ignorant? Is he impotent? Or is he, you know, simply ambivalent? Well, maybe none of those three. You're presuming that you know all three answers. You're presuming that those are the only possibilities. It could be that God is omnipotent and God is working out all things according to his will, and that his purposes are far beyond ours, and that God has also created a world where human freedom means that there are consequences of human freedom. Freedom doesn't really mean a whole lot if there are no consequences, if our actions don't actually affect anything. But that's what Satan says. Oh, well, this world is so full of pain and evil. How could there be a good God? Well, that's a stupid question. If there is not a good God who created this world, then asking questions about good and evil is kind of a moot point. In fact, it's worse than moot. It's illogical. It's incoherent. You can't ask about goodness and morality if you're rejecting God, because all those things come down to opinion without God. As Ravi Zacharias says, if you want to talk about good and evil, then you have to posit a moral law. And if you posit a moral law, you have to posit a moral lawgiver. You can't have a moral law without a moral lawgiver. It doesn't work. And if you want your law to be absolute, it has to be an objective, absolute lawgiver, a God. God is the only one who can do that. But that's what Satan does. That's what Satan does. He tries to deceive you. Because that's what Absalom's doing. He is deceiving people. He's flattering them. Satan says, oh, you're a good person. And why are bad things happening to a good person like you? Well, you know, friends, you're not a good person. You're not a good person. I'm not a good person. Nobody's ever been a good person. We've all sinned. We all fall short of the glory of God. Every single one of us. We all deserve judgment. And God in his mercy doesn't give us the judgment we deserve. But Satan wants to deceive you and say that God is somehow giving you short shrift. That's what his lie has always been. It's what his lie will always be. Pick me instead. Pick me. That's Satan's message. You'll do better. You know the Toledo, you'll do better in Toledo. Satan's message is you'll do better with Satan. Reject God, accept Satan. You'll do better with me. Now, normally in culture, it's not so open and naked as all that, but it's the message. You'll live a happier, more fulfilled life with sin. That's the message. Anyways, I've gone quite over time here this morning, so I hope you'll forgive me, but I hope this was meaningful. I hope it was helpful, and I hope to join you tomorrow as we continue to study chapter 15 of 1 Samuel. Thank you. God bless. Bye.